This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Our show today was recorded, so we won't be taking your calls this afternoon. The Federal Reserve has been in the news a lot these days as people keep an eye on whether the nation's central bank is going to raise interest rates. It seems like it's been a permanent part of America, but in terms of history, the Fed is relatively new. For nearly a century, the U.S. was alone among developed nations, refusing to consider any central or organizing agency in its financial system. That changed in 1913 when Congress enacted a controversial law that gave America its first central bank. In his new book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve, former Wall Street Journal reporter Roger Lowenstein looks at the history of the Fed and how many of the issues surrounding it are still in play today. Roger Lowenstein joins us this afternoon to discuss the history of the Federal Reserve. Roger, thank you so much for joining me today.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
In the 19th century, before the Federal Reserve was created, what was the state of the country's financial system?
Well, it's very curious because it was an industrial economy, a very advanced nation. We were just becoming the largest economy in the world, but we really had a financial system that was quite primitive, a throwback to almost the Pony Express days. Each bank, since there was no central reserve, kept its own reserve. It kept its rainy day money either in its own vault or it might deposit it with a bank in a city downstream if it was a country bank. And just to show you what that meant, every fall, cash would drain into the countryside because farmers would need cash, obviously, to finance the harvest, pay the field hands, so on. And cash would drain out of the cities, and interest rates in the cities would shoot upward. They'd go to New York sometimes to 100%. And it was just a very disorganized way of running the country. And then whenever there was a serious, enduring tightness in the financial system, banks, each individual bank would call in its loans to protect itself, but by that action, it would exacerbate the tightness throughout the country. So every bank would take an action to protect itself and make the situation for the group worse. There was no principle of collective security or collective insurance working, no central agency to lend when others were refusing to lend, and no lenders, we say, of last resort.
So it sounds like there was a lot of financial turmoil back during those times.
I counted 25 minor panics and 5 or 6 major panics or depressions in the generation before the Federal Reserve Act was created. And this was completely different, by the way, than the situation in the other major industrialized countries in Europe, where they had lenders of last resort. Central banks. In fact, after we had a really serious panic in 1907, Congress sent over a commission to study, what the situation was in Europe, and they went and interviewed bankers in various countries. And at each one of them, they said, how do you handle money panics, financial panics, and so on? And then in Europe, they kept saying, we don't have them, because the banks here know if they get into trouble, they can borrow from the central bank. And the Americans were just astonished to hear it.
So was that financial crisis of 1907 a turning point that paved the way for the Fed?
The financial crisis of 1907 was very much a turning point. And, we use the term bank run in this country, but I think people have forgotten what it really entailed, because in 2008 or in modern times, a bank run is something that happens on your computer screen, but, people don't actually run to the bank. But in 1907, they ran to the bank, and they carried satchels with them to withdraw money, as much money as they can get. There were scenes where they were screaming at the tellers, I need the cash. And banks would dole out all the money they had until they ran out, and then they'd put a foreclose sign up. And this, it just spread like wildfire, because, once people saw it hitting one bank in New York, they went to the others. Once they saw it in New York, it happened in Philadelphia and Boston, and then, moving out across the country. And what happened in 1907 was there was no Federal Reserve to come in and lend. So J.P. Morgan, the financier, did his best to organize loans. He was already an elderly man, and he was only one person. It became clear then that the system needed some reform, but there was a tremendous difference of opinion about whether this should be federal, whether it should be government, should it be centralized in Washington or not. And so quite a lot of action and drama followed.
So what was at the heart of this resistance to the idea of a central bank?
So that is the great question, and I trace it back to the days of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, really the American Revolution. We, you know, our history, a sacred part of our history, obviously, is rebelling against the English king, a far-off monarch, a tyrant, if you will, and for people in much of the country, particularly people, I think, further from the Northeast, Washington came to represent, you know, something like the English king, a far-off central government, and they didn't want to recreate, you know, what they thought they'd rebelled against in England. And, you know, that was Thomas Jefferson right on, right? I mean, Alexander Hamilton wanted a national bank, Thomas Jefferson didn't. And then, you know, there was an early experiment with a national bank, and Jefferson or his followers got rid of it. And then things didn't work out so well, so we created a second bank, and Andrew Jackson, you know, also a president from the mid-country, if you will, from the, you know, away from the Northeast. People of his stripe didn't trust Washington. They didn't trust Wall Street. They feared that a Washington bank would somehow be all mixed up with Wall Street. And even in the era of my characters, where most of the book takes place, reformers, people like Paul Warburg, Nelson Aldrich, they use this phrase. They said they were battling the ghost of Andrew Jackson because this antipathy towards centralism still lives. And if, you know, if you look at the politics of the country today, then it was the Democratic Party. Today, it's the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. But, you know, fear of Washington, fear of Wall Street is, you know, it's nothing we're not familiar with.
So were there certain parts of the country, Roger, that opposed the Federal Reserve the most?
Very much. I mean, it was the South and the West. And when I say the West, or when they said the West back in the early 1900s, they meant Chicago. They meant the Middle West. But farm districts and you know, farm districts were like half the country, half the population lived in. So there was a major part of the economy. But the further you got from big cities, the further you got from New York, Washington, the more opposed people were. The same districts today, by the way, that vote, in a populist, often a Tea Party pattern, were very much opposed then. In fact, one of the most vociferous opponents in 1913, the year the legislation was passed, was Charles Lindbergh Sr., the father of the famous aviator. He was a very populist congressman, didn't trust Washington for a minute, said this monster you're creating, the Federal Reserve, is going to take over the economy and so on, take over the country. His district later on was represented by Michelle Bachmann, the storied Tea Party crusader. So there are certain, forget party lines, there are certain geographic patterns in the country that endure. And I'm sure that, you know, those are the areas of the country where the Fed is the least popular and the least accepted today.
And what was the attitude toward banking in general back then? I mean, it was a pretty hostile attitude, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, banks, there were banks and then there were banks. So there were country banks that typically lent to farmers and so on. They didn't have a lot of capital, so they didn't have a lot to lend. But, people in the farm districts felt okay about then. But when it came to, let's say if you were a farmer in Ohio, when it came to the big bank in Cincinnati or Cleveland, there was more wariness. And when it came to the really big banks in New York, people were completely hostile. And you had people like William Jennings Bryan, who's a big character in the book, who completely didn't trust the banks. And that became very important because Woodrow Wilson got Democratic nomination with Bryan's help, wouldn't have gotten it without him. And as to repay the favor, Bryan was made Wilson's Secretary of State. He was very powerful among Democrats in Congress. When they drew up the Federal Reserve Act, in the beginning, there were going to be bankers chosen by bankers on the Federal Reserve Board. William Jennings Bryan, who reflected this attitude you mentioned about this Midwestern mistrust of bankers, said to Wilson, over my dead body, he was going to resign unless Wilson agreed to change the format and make the Federal Reserve Board members politically appointed or responsible to the public, and Wilson did that.
To some extent, it sounds like the suspicions and the issues surrounding banking and the idea of a central bank are pretty similar to what you hear today.
Yeah, I mean, today there are bills in Congress that would strip the Fed of a lot of its independence, subject the daily monetary decisions to oversight by elected officials. We can talk about that one if you want. You know, people running for office, should they be entrusted with interest rate decisions? You know, further out on the political spectrum, you know, Rand Paul would argue to basically abolish the Fed, go back to the gold standard, let the money supply be up to the mining industry, basically. But the tensions, you know, haven't changed. And the suspicion of bankers hasn't changed. And you know, by the way, I should add, bankers were just as capable of behaving badly at times back then as they are now. So, you know, today you might have Elizabeth Warren very critical of the banking industry, and back then you had William Jennings Bryan. In fact, when Wilson was posed with this dilemma by Bryan, you know, either change the act to make it government appointees or lose it, he was first at a quandary, and he went to an advisor of his, later very famous advisor, Louis Brandeis, and he said, "What do I do?" And Brandeis said, "You absolutely got to go with Bryan. You got to make him public appointees. They can't be bankers." And he said, even in an area in which bankers are experts, you can't trust their expertise because they're always going to give you an answer that's self-interested. And you know, you can imagine a populist giving the same advice today to someone in Washington today.
Do you think the Federal Reserve Act would have been passed had Woodrow Wilson not been president?
That's a great question. And, you know, we tend to remember the Wilson of World War One. The president who failed to keep us out of the war and then failed to pass the to get America to join the League of Nations, who had a stroke later in his term and was an unhappy and ultimately unsuccessful figure. But the Wilson that's covered in this book, he's just been elected president. He's full of ideals and passion. He had a lightning rise through politics barely a year and a half after his entry into public service. He'd been president of Princeton College, elected governor of New Jersey. No more than a year and a half later, he was nominated for president, you know, of the United States. He comes in brimming with ideas, and not only that, with political savvy and cunning, and in a way that might remind modern readers of Lyndon Johnson. He got legislators to knuckle down. In some cases, they were, you know, under his knuckles, and got this bill through. Made some tough compromises, like the one I alluded to about putting, making the Federal Reserve Board governors public servants. But without Wilson, I do not think the act would have passed then or perhaps for a very long time.
Talking with Roger Lowenstein, his new book is America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve Bank. And what was the whole debate like? Describe that, the leading up to the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. I mean, what was going on in the halls of Congress?
Well, it was extremely contentious because you just had so many different interests represented. You had bankers not agreeing with farmers. You had amongst the bankers themselves, bankers on Wall Street didn't agree with the bankers in Chicago. The bankers in Chicago were afraid that the whole thing would be a Wall Street, you know, run situation. The bankers in Chicago said, you know, better than that, we should institute branch banking and let big city banks distribute their own notes. And when the bankers in the countryside, you know, heard that the big Chicago banks wanted to have branch banking, they said, oh boy, this is going to put us out of business. So the bankers themselves were divided. Then you had, as we've discussed, different regions of the country divided against each other. For me, it was fascinating. Washington, this is before the era of air conditioning. Washington was a very hot town. So Wilson, President Wilson's wife, decamped for New Hampshire, a cooler climate. So you got to hear Wilson's thoughts, his private thoughts, as he's writing his wife day in, day out about which committees are going to give him trouble, which he's going to be able to deal with. You know, when the press writes something, he'll either say this is trouble, he'll say, don't worry about this, they're making a lot of noise, but it's going to pass. And you get this contemporaneous record of this legislative battle.
What was the compromise that the Fed founders came up with to get this whole thing rolling?
Well, the big tension was, should this be what degree of centralization should we have? You know, should we have the Hamilton idea of a strong central reserve, or should we stick with the Jefferson idea of disparate localized government. And when Carter Glass, your listeners may know from the Glass-Steagall Act later on, but he was a Virginia Democrat, a Southern Democrat. He was very much in the laissez-faire Thomas Jefferson tradition. He didn't want federalize anything, partly because he was very much a segregationist, and he realized that federal power would threaten the system of racial segregation in Virginia. He was the head of the Banking Committee in the House. When Wilson was elected, before he took office, Glass took a draft. Everyone knew there would have to be some sort of reform bill. Glass took a draft to Wilson up in Princeton, where Wilson lived. This 2 days after Christmas, 1912, and he showed him a plan that had absolutely no federal element whatsoever. It called for 20 different reserve banks around the country, completely unaffiliated. So there'd be a reserve bank in Florida, one in Texas, maybe one in the mountain states, 20 of them around the country. And Wilson, who had been a college president, been a noted writer of American history before that, written a very famous multi-volume history of American history, knew as Alexander Hamilton, knew what was going on in other countries in the world, said, "You're on the right track, but you need a capstone," he called it, something that would sit above these individual reserve banks. And what they came up with was a compromise really modeled on the compromise in the American Constitution. So we would have individual reserve banks around the country and San Francisco and Richmond and Kansas City and Dallas.
So there's not as much centralized authority.
There's not. So it's not like the Bank of England, where there's just one Bank of England, or the Reichsbank in Germany, where there's just one Reichsbank. We have 12 around the country. But nonetheless, they would report to and be supervised by a Federal Reserve Board in Washington, very much mimicking, I think, what we have in the political realm, where we have state governments and superseded by a federal government.
Do you think the Federal Reserve Act could be passed today?
That is a great question, and I have my doubts. I think if they tried to pass the Federal Reserve Act today, given the temper of what's in Congress today, I think it would have less independence. It would more be beholden to Congress. For instance, there's a bill in Congress that says the Federal Reserve has got to enunciate what rule it sets interest rates by, and if it ever deviates from that rule, it's got to explain exactly why. So whereas when the Fed was created, there was a trust reposed in the body and flexibility granted, the temper of the Congress today is not so much flexibility, not so much we trust you, and it's much more, you're going to have to answer to us day by day. And So I think it would be a very different Federal Reserve, and probably one with less flexibility to act in a crisis when we needed it to act.
Speaking of interest rates, Roger, did the Fed, has it always had these battles between the interest rate hawks and the doves, just as you see today?
Yes, another good question. The mechanisms have changed. So in 1913, the debate wasn't so much about interest rates. It wasn't about the what we call today the federal funds rate. But there were tremendous battles between hawks and doves, between people who said this institution you're creating isn't going to create enough currency, it's going to be deflationary, and between people who said this is going to create a terrible inflation. There were congressmen down in Texas who wanted Federal Reserve notes to be, the new money they were creating, to be much more widespread. And he said, basically, any farmer with a warehouse receipt should be able to turn that into Federal Reserve notes. So, he wanted money, in effect, to be backed by corn. And that was a more inflationary standard that was, popular in farm districts. And then bankers in New York wanted, not surprisingly, to have a tighter standard. So although the particulars that they argued about were different, some of the mechanics of banking were different back then, the debate was basically the same. Is this thing going to be inflationary? Is it going to debase the money? Or, on the other hand, is it going to be too tight? Is it going to send us into a depression?
So if you look in your crystal ball, what do you see in the future for the Fed? Are the opponents going to get their way, or is this an institution that's going to be with us for a long time?
I think it will be with us, but I think it faces a real struggle right now. I think the federal government, in many ways, we're living through a period when one of the two major parties regularly has in its docket plans to try to shut down the federal government. So that's That wasn't always the case, although it's been the case, the case in the Civil War, it was in the case during some of the Jackson era. So we're living through a very challenged period for the federal government in general, and particularly for the Federal Reserve. One thing I think Janet Yellen could do to help her cause, it's very important for the Fed to be independent, not only independent of Congress, but of the White House and the executive. During a crisis such as we lived through in the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, it's natural for the Fed and the government to work more as partners. But now that we've moved out of the crisis period, I think it's very important for Janet Yellen and the Fed to reassert the Fed's independence, not only of the Congress, but of the government, and to take some, to start taking some decisions, even if they disappoint the people in the executive, the people in the Treasury, and the people in the White House.
Roger, thank you so much for joining me today.
A pleasure to be on the show.
Former Wall Street Journal reporter Roger Lowenstein, his new book is America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. Coming up, Ann Thompson looks at the work being done to make driverless cars safe in Focus on Technology.